Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing concerns about the damage Donald Trump is doing to the rule of law and trust in the justice system in this country as he undermines the Department of Justice and attacks the credibility and impartiality of the FBI almost on a daily basis. Richard Primus, a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and has a new paper at the Michigan Law Review, The Republic in Long-Term Perspective, joins us to discuss Trump's bad man attitude to the law. Now, as a result of the ceaseless trashing of the FBI by the President of the United States, FBI agents testifying in court are being seen by some jurors as agents of the deep state. Furthermore, Trump's call to outlaw what he calls flippers, confidential informants who flip and testify against other criminals, is seen by prosecutors as an invitation to wholesale criminality, since flipping is an essential tool used across the board by federal, state, and local law enforcement, without which mob bosses and drug kingpins would have impunity. With our president sounding more and more like a mob boss instead of the leader upholding the rule of law, which underpins our democracy, we'll assess how long the damage Trump is doing to the law will last. And as the social fabric of the country is shredded by his incivility, division, and desecration, whether since Trump has shown the way another bad leader could emerge as an effective would-be strongman rather than a bumbling one we have now. Then, with this whole week dedicated to praising the memory of John McCain leading up to Saturday's ceremony at which Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama will eulogize the late senator while the current president will be conspicuously absent, we will hear from a critic of McCain and his record and legacy. Bill Zimmerman, an author and longtime activist who was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s, joins us. Then finally, we'll hear from the National Director of Communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain, Dan Schnur. He is now the director of the Jesse M. Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California, and we will discuss McCain's recent efforts to bridge the depth of division and heal our polarized politics, with an example of the challenge ahead being how some supporters of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez blasted the rising star on the political left for her sympathetic tweet in support of Senator McCain. And joining us now is Richard Primus, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who teaches the law, theory, and history of the U.S. Constitution, the recipient of the first ever Guggenheim Fellowship in Constitutional Studies. He previously clerked on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and for the United States Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He has a new paper at the Michigan Law Review, The Republic in Long-Term Perspective. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Primus.
Happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Richard. And our president of late has really exhibited more characteristics of a mob boss than the leader of a country that's based on the rule of law. I mean, lately he's been saying about his campaign manager who was just convicted, saying, be strong, implying, don't rat out, maybe I'll pardon you. He called, in a tweet recently, he called John Dean a rat. And he railed against what he called flipping as though he was a mob boss, because mob bosses don't like their mafia lieutenants flipping on them. My understanding is that there's already signs within the court system of this country, because of Trump's attacks on the DOJ and in particular on the FBI, that in some cases now, when FBI agents give testimony, the juries don't believe them as they used to. They maybe think that they're agents of the deep state. And also, in attacking what Trump calls flipping, confidential informants are the basis of law enforcement across the board, not just the FBI, but all the way down to municipal law enforcement. They rely on people on the inside giving testimony. So if you go after that mechanism in the law and try to discredit it, that's doing long-term devastating damage.
Yes, it's almost unimaginable. It's a wholesale attack on fundamentals of how the legal system works. And I think it should provoke us to notice a big picture way in which President Trump has a different approach to law from really any president who's been before him. And I would say not just president, I would say, you know, public officials through history. So think of two different perspectives for thinking about what law is, what the legal system is. Right? One is that law is a system for ordering society fairly. There are going to be a bunch of rules. They're not going to be perfect, but we'll make them as well as we can. And the point of the rules in general is not to deliver the goodies to any specific person, but to create a set of ground rules that basically let everyone go about their lives, you know, reasonably well, right, in ways that are sort of reasonably fair to everyone and reasonably well facilitate what people want to do with their lives. And you take the sort of systemic fairness approach view of it. That's the view that you would expect or want a government and government officials to have. Right? They should think about law in terms of its systemic effects, in terms of its fairness, in terms of how well it lets society function. Then there's a different view of the law. It's a view that the great Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, 100 years ago, called the bad man view of the law. And the bad man view of the law goes like this. Holmes was talking about what it's like when a client sits in a lawyer's office. And Holmes said, when your client says, tell me the law and nothing else, what he's asking is not explain to me how this system works for everyone. He's asking, what is going to happen to me on the basis of this system? Right? If I do X, what will the government do to me, if anything? Now, there are times in life when it's appropriate to take what Holmes called the bad man view. You're a business and you're trying to figure out, can I do this transaction or can I not do this transaction? And the question that you ask is, well, does the law permit it or not? Can I do, what are the consequences to me? But you can't be a government and take the bad man view of the law, right? I mean, you, the government has to think about the whole system. What's remarkable about Trump is that he's the president, he's the head of state, he's the head of law enforcement, and he seems very deeply to have the capacity only to have the bad man view of the law. The law is, what can it do for me, and what will it do to me, and how can I advance my own interests within it? That's not a healthy perspective for a government to have. It's a terrible perspective for people with the power to enforce the law to have. It's corrosive of the basis of a well-working legal system. And Americans, you know, our legal system is far from perfect. There are flaws, some small, some deep, of all kinds in the American legal system. And systems of government and legal systems, they need to be graded around, they need to be graded on a curve. There's no such thing as a perfect government or a perfect legal system. And so the one question to ask is, measured by the functioning of legal systems around the world and through human history, you know, how good or how bad is this one? You know, would you want to trade it in for what's behind door number two in some other country or in some other century? And looked at that way, the American legal system, for all its really serious flaws, for a long time has been pretty good, you know, pretty stable. Most of the time, you know what you can do to stay out of trouble. Most of the time, you know, petty government officials don't come knocking on your door and extorting bribes. We take that for granted in this country. We take for granted a certain level of impartiality and professionalism in the court system and in a lot of law enforcement that a lot of people around the world and through human history have not been able to take for granted. We make a big mistake if we assume that it's just in the nature of America that the good things about our system cannot deteriorate and become more like systems in other places in the world and through history where you cannot count on that kind of impartiality and well-functioning of the legal system. That would be really bad, and we cannot count on its never happening.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Primus, who's professor of law at the University of Michigan, who teaches the law, theory, and history of the U.S. Constitution. He's the recipient of the first ever Guggenheim Fellowship in Constitutional Studies, and he previously clerked on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And he has a new paper at the Michigan Law Review, The Republic in Long-Term Perspective. So did Trump get this view of the law, or the bad view of the law, from his legal mentor and former counsel, who was also counsel to the Gambino crime family, and I think another one of the Genovese crime family as well, the New York Mafia? Trump's business model, the Trump Organization's business model, is emerging now as essentially a money laundering operation for mob money from Russia and oligarch ill-gotten gains from Russia. So can you blame this on Roy Cohn?
Well, I don't know how much I can blame on him. That is to say, I'm sure that Donald Trump wasn't a blank slate earlier. But if the question is it a common view, common, you know, to Donald Trump and also to Roy Cohn and to a bunch of other people like that, to take the bad man view of the law, the answer is clearly yes. But here's what I want to emphasize. The bad man view of the law is an appropriate view of the law for people to take in some social roles. If you're a lawyer appointed to defend a client, your job is to advance the interests of that client as well as you can. Your job in that role isn't to think about the system as a whole and is it being fair to everyone. Your job is to help this client. And that means you ask, well, how can I work this system? What will this system do to my client if I do A or if I do B? And my job is to zealously advance the interests of my client. The system is built to let lawyers who are trying to advance the interests of particular businesses or particular individuals all do that. But it's not built to let the judges and the police officers and the legislators do that. They have to take a more systemic view where they ask, is this going to work for the public in general? And through history, we've had lots and lots of people in lawmaking and law enforcement roles in this country who used to be private lawyers. It's a normal career path. So all of those people had the experience of being in a role where their job was to use the legal system to advance a particular person's interests rather than to try to use it, you know, to make everybody better off. But what most of them have managed to do is switch perspectives when they reach high office. Now, that doesn't mean that people who reach high office never try to deliver the goodies to themselves or their own people. That happens too, right? Sometimes there's corruption, sometimes there's political deal-making, and so forth. But Trump is different in that he doesn't seem to have access to the idea of law as a system for the fair ordering of society that might constrain him and his interests. He seems as if he can only inhabit the bad man view of the law. And that means that if he thinks he can get away with something, there isn't any reason not to do it. That's really dangerous. The legal system relies on most people, the overwhelming majority of people, most of the time, to comply with the law voluntarily. There aren't enough police officers to police everyone all the time. You know, most people pay their taxes most of the time, not because they're going to get audited and sent to prison otherwise, but because they think it's the thing that they're supposed to do. And same with all kinds of other rule following. If you think that the only reason to obey the law, to be limited in the prosecution of your own interests by the law, is that some consequence might come to you, you're going to wind up breaking a lot of laws. And if the chief law enforcement officer has the view that if he can get away with something, there isn't a reason not to do it, that's deeply destructive to the culture of the legal system.
Well, I thought out of the Manafort trial, two lessons emerged, one hopeful and one alarming. The fact that the juror that appeared on Fox News was able to say why they got a hung jury on 10 of the counts and they convicted on 8 was because of this one holdout. But this particular juror who went public made it clear that she was a huge fan of Trump's. She had a Make America Great Again baseball cap in her car, and she said she'd still vote for Trump, even though she ruled to convict his campaign manager. And I think that is encouraging, because she put politics aside as a citizen and did her duty based upon the evidence and the law. The other aspect is that person who apparently simply could not be reached with reason and logic. She sort of reminds me of the 30% of people locked in the Fox News bubble that blindly support Trump and are immune to facts and evidence. And no matter, they kept saying to her, why are you resisting the unanimous count of this jury? And she would say, because I still have reasonable doubt. And they say, well, what is your reasonable doubt? And she couldn't say what her reasonable doubt is. It sort of reminds me of the fact that 100 years ago, one of the most powerful political movements in this country was called the Know-Nothing Movement. And that is exactly the way this juror sounds, like a know-nothing. So that's what I find alarming. I don't know, when you scratch the surface, how many people in this country could be members of the new know-nothing movement. So that is the two lessons, at least, that I got from the Manafort trial. What's your opinion?
So on the second thing, I think it's very difficult to know. I think it's, even when jurors talk, it's very difficult to know what really happens inside a jury room. It's very difficult to know why a juror convicts on 8 counts and not on 10 others when the evidence seems very strong. And I'm reluctant to speculate. Though, of course, you know, there always is a risk that people will behave irrationally in juries. That's a risk built into the system. On the first thing that you said, I think this is crucial. The willingness of Americans, citizens and officials both, to differentiate between politics and law, to differentiate between partisan interest and constitutional ground rules, is fundamentally necessary if the system is going to survive. But if everything is a no-holds-barred attempt to win this round for your political side, the system simply disintegrates. I like to tell my constitutional law students, constitutional government is like playground basketball. If you care more about winning this round than about respecting your opponent in the spirit of the game, pretty much there won't be a game at all. It will just break down. And that means that people have to be willing to do, you know, what this juror, as you described her, was willing to do, right? And to say, this is not about my political interest or preference here. There are some rules that we abide by, and it also requires people who hold powerful offices to be able to say, I'm not going to go, you know, to the mat to win this particular round every time if doing so causes damage to the system. We used to be much better at that 40 or 60 years ago than we are now. That's a basic problem that we face that will probably not disappear when Trump goes. It is the deeper problem that we will really have to work out and solve if we are going to put our constitutional system back on a better footing again.
Well, let me read a little from your Michigan Law Review paper, The Republic in Long-Term Perspective. You say that, more acutely, the Trump administration is proof of a concept. A self-interested, unprincipled, out-of-control bully can run for president of the United States and win. Once everyone knows that, it seems plausible that other self-interested bullies will want to get in on the action. So after Trump is gone, what will the next guy look like? What if his values are just as bad as Trump's, but he has more talent for getting things done? What if the future president to whom Trump has shown the way is an effective, would-be strong man rather than a bumbling one? That's a cold shower, Richard.
That's one of the scenarios that keeps me up at night. You know, I think that we have to look that possibility squarely in the face. 3 years ago, most well-informed, properly socialized observers of American government thought that something like a Trump presidency was not possible. It was my view. I didn't think it could happen until well into 2016. I was wrong. Now everyone knows it's possible. And therefore, and we would make a big mistake to think that this is as bad as it can get. Maybe it will get better. Maybe the country will react to Trump in more or less the way that it reacted to Watergate. After Watergate, the federal government reacted with a bunch of good government reforms that cleaned up a lot of problems in government. Right? We had a negative experience and learned from it, and we're launched in a better direction for some time as a result. Maybe we will react that way. But that's not guaranteed. We could also continue to deteriorate. It could turn out, exactly as that passage suggests, that what is waiting in the wings to follow after Trump is just as damaging or more so, and the door has been opened. And here's really the most important thing. The question of which of those two futures is our future is not a question the answer to which has been determined yet. It depends on what we do. Both roads are there. And which one we wind up going down depends entirely on what Americans bestir themselves to do now. So it's very important for Americans who take public duty seriously and who would like law and government to function well to recognize that we are living through a moment in history that will probably be looked back on as a moment where things could have gone in radically different directions, a moment like the 1780s or the 1860s or the 1940s. And the question you will ask for the rest of your life is, what did I do then? Did I help try to move us onto the good path? Because right now, both paths are open.
Well, Richard Primus, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Primus, a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who teaches the law, theory, and history of the U.S. Constitution, the recipient of the first ever Guggenheim Fellowship in Constitutional Studies. He previously clerked on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And he has a new paper at the Michigan Law Review, The Republic in Long-Term Perspective. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a criticism of John McCain, his record, and legacy.
I'm your masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants, who co-founded the political consulting and advertising firm Zimmerman and Markman, Inc. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Zimmerman.
Thank you, Ian.
And Bill, I took your advice yesterday and did interview the head of security for the Students for Democratic Society, who, of course, we talked about this as being the 50th anniversary of the Chicago riots surrounding the Democratic Convention in August of 1968. So tell me about...
I assume that was Marilyn that you talked to.
I talked to Marilyn, right. And one of the things I asked her about was that The day after Trump was inaugurated, there was a spontaneous demonstration of millions of women around the world. Mostly there were men, of course, involved protesting across the United States and around the world. But it doesn't appear to be a sustained movement, or it certainly hasn't been sustained since that day after the inauguration. And likewise, the anti-war movement, when Nixon ended the war in Vietnam, all of that political energy seemed to dissipate. So is that a problem with the politics of the left, that they can't create sustaining movements?
Well, I think it's a problem of politics in general. Certainly, the left has had the problem numerous times. I remember, for example, in March of 2003, there were millions of people in the streets in this country and around the world protesting the upcoming American invasion of Iraq. And 17 months later, when the president who launched that invasion was up for re-election in 2004, the American people re-elected him because the left couldn't sustain its opposition to the war over that period of time. I hope that's not the case this year and that the anticipated blue wave will actually rise and crash over the Trump administration. But I'm not confident that it will, because it's very difficult to sustain the kind of enthusiasm that was unleashed in that demonstration the day after Trump was elected or inaugurated.
Well, John Kerry and Edwards, his vice president, both had an opportunity to vote against the authorization of the Iraq War. Senator Graham was the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He told all of his colleagues that the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, which the Bush administration reluctantly put forth, was completely bogus, and that the justification for the war was absolutely flimsy. And all the Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee, with the exceptions of John Edwards and Senator Feinstein, voted along with Kerry and Hillary Clinton to authorize that war. So do you see that as a failure of the loyal opposition?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's characteristic of elected Democrats to fail to stand up in national security and military matters when people lead the country astray. And to some extent, I think we're seeing the same thing today in the fawning over the death of Senator John McCain. Democrats should be pointing out the terrible policy positions that McCain has taken over the course of his life, including being the principal cheerleader in the Senate for the Iraq War, not just at its beginning, but even years after that beginning, when it was clearly demonstrated to be a failure. McCain was still out there advocating continuation and escalation. And today, Democrats who came to oppose the Iraq War are loath to point out, in this symphony of sympathy we see for McCain, which I see as inappropriate, that he's been a political opponent of everything Democrats have stood for, going back to his vote when he first went to Congress against making Martin Luther King's birthday a national holiday.
Well, Bill, interviewed a couple of days ago Norm Ornstein, who worked with Senator McCain on the McCain-Feingold bill, and he obviously had some good things to say about the senator, as we've been hearing throughout these days and throughout this whole week until Saturday, when the two former presidents will eulogize him, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and conspicuously absent, of course, will be the current president, Donald Trump. I've got some pretty nasty mail from listeners saying I was a sellout for talking to Norm. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she tweeted out, "John McCain's legacy represents an unparalleled example of human decency and American service. As an intern, I learned a lot about the power of humanity in government through his deep friendship with Senator Kennedy. He meant so much to so many. My prayers are with his family." And she got roundly trashed by a lot of her followers as a sellout too. So what is this animus all about? I mean, the reason I'm talking to you is that we're not hearing the critical assessment of John McCain at this moment. But that, I suppose, does that have something to do with not speaking ill of the dead?
Well, I suppose so. But, you know, every American man or woman in politics is inevitably a mix of good intentions and bad, good votes and bad. And there's no denying that on occasion McCain voted the right way or said the right thing. But evaluating his career overall, one comes to a very negative conclusion. I think McCain probably took the most reckless act that any American candidate for president has ever taken in the nomination of Sarah Palin for vice president in 2008. He, at the time, was 69 years old, the oldest major party candidate for president who had ever run. He knew, as everyone in Washington does, that one out of every four vice presidents becomes president. Everybody knows that story because Johnson famously said to Helen Gahagan Douglas when she asked him why he accepted the vice presidency under his rival John Kennedy, that, quote, he was a gambling man, and the odds were one in four. So McCain was facing even longer odds, given his age. And he nominated for vice president a person who, had she become president, would have been an utter and obvious disaster. One can also argue that her introduction into American politics in 2008 set the stage for Trump's election 8 years later in 2016. She so demeaned the electoral process and so turned it into a demolition derby with no regard for the country's history or the norms that had established representative government in this country. She empowered a constituency that felt, perhaps in some cases, properly isolated from the American mainstream. But she gave them a political boost that led to Trump's being able to organize them into a majority political force. And the only reason McCain picked her as his running mate was rank opportunism. He saw a possible opening for gathering more votes in his failing presidential campaign, and he accepted the advice of advisors that she might provide a little bit of an electoral edge. That kind of opportunism that so endangered the country, to me, is the most fundamental fact about John McCain's public life. And that, of course, is complicated, as I said before, by him becoming a cheerleader for the Iraq War, when that war was probably the biggest foreign policy mistake in the history of the country, even including Vietnam, given the kind of terrorism that we now have to deal with as our number one security concern. And while we're on the subject of terrorism, let's also consider how John McCain first became a leading figure in American politics, the myth that he was a war hero. I don't know how you call someone a war hero whose job it is to murder innocent non-combatant women and children, which was what McCain was doing when he was shot down over North Vietnam, bombing peasant villages in the countryside. That's not heroism. He was shot down and he was severely beaten when he was shot down. But I have to say, if I was in one of those villages and watched the consequence of the napalm that he was dropping on civilians, I would have grabbed my pitchfork and run out to the crash site and tried to stick it in him, you know, just like others did. Now, he was eventually saved from a vigilante death and given to the North Vietnamese government and treated for 5 years as a prisoner of war. He was tortured, apparently, during the first year or two of his captivity. But we know from internal documents that have since been released by the North Vietnamese government that the torture of prisoners stopped a year or two after McCain was shot down. And yet, throughout his political career, he allowed people to continually talk about how he was tortured for the five and a half years that he was held captive there. That was a convenient lie that increased his stature as a war hero, but bore no relationship to the truth. So you see the kind of political opportunism that characterizes his entire career, beginning there in Vietnam. He was a cheerleader for war during that entire, 30, 40-year public career that he enjoyed in this country. And yes, he made a couple of good votes for campaign finance reform and a few other issues. He spoke up against Donald Trump, the worst president the country has ever had. I'm glad that he spoke up against Trump, but I don't think he deserves to be congratulated for doing something so obvious and so needed as to oppose this madman being elected to the White House. So to me, this whole spasm of hero worship we're going through is highly misplaced, and any examination of his actual career, voting record, and personal performance and behavior during his political career reveals someone who is very flawed and in no way deserving of all the honors that both Democrats and Republicans are trying to heap on him today.
Well, just to touch on your point about Sarah Palin, my sense is that that is indeed the most damaging legacy that anybody could probably have, because it seems as though Sarah Palin being catapulted to national prominence opened the door for the Know-Nothing movement to be revived. 100 years ago, it was a powerful anti-immigrant movement that was relentlessly anti-intellectual. And the reason they were called the Know-Nothings was if you ask them what they stood for, they say they know nothing. It's very much like the juror on the Manafort trial that caused a hung jury on 10 of the 18 counts. They kept asking her, you know, what's your problem? You know, when you say you still have reasonable doubt, and she couldn't explain what the reasonable doubt she had was. So there's about 30% of the country in that Fox News bubble that I think you can trace the lineage from the emergence of Sarah Palin through to Trump. And now that that can of worms has been opened, do you think we have a permanent know-nothing constituency in this country?
Well, I hope it's not permanent, but we certainly have a 30% constituency, as you just described. The country is in a fascinating political moment. About 30% of the country supports Trump and Palin and people like that. There's probably another 30% that supports Bernie Sanders and progressive Democrats. And then there's 30 or 40% in the middle that is primarily apolitical, moderate Republicans, moderate Democrats who don't pay a lot of attention to politics and are generally afraid of change. And they now have allowed the right wing to get enough of their votes to control all three branches of government. But I think it's not a stable coalition. We will see in November if it lasts. It seems to me that a lot of the moderates in the middle that will determine the outcome of the election in November, and indeed determine the outcome of most elections, It seems to me they're tilting against the Trump administration and the know-nothing approach to government. But it's a little too early to make predictions about what's going to happen in November. Even if we lose and the know-nothings prevail again, I think it's hopefully... It's not right to describe it as a permanent phenomenon. Politics is too volatile. Change is too common for anything to be permanent in American politics. Whether it's permanent or not is going to depend on whether we can organize a clearer vision of what this country can be, whether we can put out solutions to problems of employment and education and immigration that inspire people who so far have not been inspired. But if the Democrats continue to push the same message they've always pushed and continue to be so timid they can't raise criticisms of someone like John McCain, then I think we're going to be stuck with the present situation for a long time.
Well, Bill Zimmerman, I thank you for joining us here today.
Glad to be here, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Bill Zimmerman, an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants. He co-founded the political consulting and advertising firm Zimmerman & Markman, Inc., and previously was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org, and is the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with the communications director of the McCain 2000 presidential campaign. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dan Schnur, who is a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications and the University of California's Berkeley Institute of Government Studies. For years, Dan was one of California's leading political and media strategists, whose record includes work on 4 presidential and 3 gubernatorial campaigns, and he served as the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Schnur.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dan. And we just heard a criticism of John McCain's record and legacy, and I spoke the other day with Norm Ornstein, who worked with Senator McCain on the McCain-Feingold bill, and I got some nasty mail from listeners saying, you know, that I was being, you know, being soft and in the same kind of criticism that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got. She got blasted, and she's a rising star on the political left. She got blasted for her sympathetic tweets in support of Senator McCain, both being referred to as sellouts. So what is this animus on the left to your mind?
Well, look, some of it is not just predictable partisanship, but frankly, when that predictable partisanship extends beyond the grave, it's a little bit disappointing. I would hope that when a longtime public servant, whether liberal or conservative, passes away, that even those who disagree with that individual on the issues can offer some respect to that individual for his or her service. So whether John McCain or Ted Kennedy or anyone in between, I think at a certain point it's worth putting aside the longstanding partisan differences, and I think that's one of the reasons that President Trump has come under such criticism. But for a very strong, progressive voice on the political spectrum, John McCain is a disappointing figure, because although he was willing to work across party lines on some issues, issues like campaign finance reform, for some time on immigration, on health care, and on others, when push came to shove, for the most part, he was a very staunch, very traditional conservative. And unlike most conservatives who didn't necessarily make those efforts toward bipartisanship on the type of issues I was talking about, I think McCain may have elicited more anger from the left, ironically enough, because of those occasional efforts. If he had just been a predictable conservative, it would be sort of easy to overlook him. But when he would work across party lines, maybe that elicited a little bit of false hope. And, yeah, it's understandable that people would be disappointed in the heat of the political fray. But when a man passes away, particularly a dedicated public servant, Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, I wish people would be able to show the kind of respect that Ms. Ocasio-Cortez did and that many others on both sides of the aisle have.
So did John McCain have second thoughts about the Vietnam War? I understand he definitely had second thoughts about Senator Palin. Those were the two criticisms, and, of course, his support for the Iraq.
I'm not sure you just equated Sarah Palin with his experience in the Vietnam War, so you should probably...
I meant to add the Iraq War as well. Let's start with the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, and then deal with Sarah Palin, because I think I had read and heard that he did have second thoughts about, or regrets, I should say. But starting on the two wars, the Vietnam and the Iraq War, did he ever have second thoughts about his support for both those wars?
It sounds like you and I have read different things and heard different things about his experience, Ian, because my understanding is as follows. The lesson that Senator McCain took away from the Vietnam War, in his own words, words that he expressed any number of times over the decades, was that if the United States or any country is going to engage in a military action, that number one, it needs to commit its full resources to accomplishing victory in that action, and that trying to do it in a halfway manner is not going to lead to success. And the second lesson he learned from that experience is that it's incumbent upon any government, any nation's government, American or otherwise, to be honest with its citizenry about the progress and chances for success in that war. I don't interpret either of those observations as second thoughts or regrets, but you're certainly entitled to come to your own conclusions.
No, I was asking you whether he had second thoughts about it, because obviously he and Senator Kerry went to Vietnam and normalized relations, and I understand that John McCain is probably the most popular American in Vietnam, in spite of the fact that he was bombing the country during the war.
No, and I think that's an excellent point, and I appreciate your clarification. But as I understand it, again, and I don't claim to have absolute knowledge on this, I don't believe that Senator McCain's efforts to work with Senator Kerry to repair relationships with Vietnam indicated a regret for the U.S. engagement in the war over there. As I mentioned a moment ago, he learned lessons about how he believes American military force ought to be applied, and as or more importantly, the importance of an American government being honest with its citizens about the conduct and progress of a war. But as I understand it, he worked to repair those relationships in the 1990s, not by way of apology or regret, but simply recognizing, as he said on many occasions, that he held no ill will toward the people of Vietnam, and that there was no reason that many years after the end of the war that the two countries couldn't forge a positive working relationship, which, thanks to him and to Senator Kerry, they have.
So can you briefly touch on the Iraq War? Again, I'm asking you whether you know that he ever expressed any regrets, because he was quite a champion of that war, and particularly of the surge towards the end of that war.
Well, and once again, I think the lesson that he drew from the Iraq War is very similar to the one that he drew from Vietnam, which is once a nation, any nation, makes the very difficult decision to engage in military action and needs to employ all the forces at its disposal in order to complete that action as quickly as possible, as to lessen the suffering to the greatest degree possible. And I think one of the reasons that he urged the Bush administration so strongly for the surge, the influx of additional troops, was not in order to prolong the war, but in order to conclude it. And upon the conclusion of the war, at least that stage of it, depending on your definition, I'm not aware he regretted either the original decision or the decision to push for a stronger military presence over there. Once again, the fundamental conclusion that I think ties these two wars together in his mind, and I don't mean to speak for him, of course, is that once a country makes that difficult decision to go to war, it's obligated to do everything it can to achieve victory as quickly as possible in order to alleviate the suffering to the greatest degree possible.
Well, the regrets that I had heard on the record were about Palin. Is that, am I accurate on that one? That he did have second thoughts afterwards. I don't know when, but did you come across anything like that?
Well, as it's been well chronicled that in 2008, and I should stress for your listeners that while I was happy to be involved in the 2000 campaign, I was not a part of the 2008 effort. But it's been well chronicled and well reported that Senator McCain's original choice to be his running mate was former Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut. And he thought that forging a bipartisan ticket would send an important message of bipartisanship and unity. He was convinced, for reasons that we can discuss, that that would not be the right choice. And it's also been well reported that the decision to select Palin was a very rushed one and a very hurried one. Some of his advisors have admitted that the campaign did not vet her and her background to the degree that normally happens under those circumstances. And I think it's fairly clear that if you watch, go online, go on YouTube and watch a video of McCain's announcement of Palin as his running mate just prior to the Republican National Convention in 2008. And if you watch him watching her, you see what looks to me, at least, like a great deal of surprise on his face. He introduced her and was told when she was presented to him that she was a political reformer. It's pretty clear to me, even on that very first announcement event, that he didn't realize that in addition to a reformer, he was getting a cultural warrior. And, you know, clearly that's something that had a very significant impact on his campaign. And no question, he's expressed regret on this, as on many other occasions, when he would have been better off following his first instinct.
Well, just briefly then, let's touch on the campaign that you were the communication director for, the McCain 2000 campaign. I recall in New Hampshire and early in the campaign that in many ways he was sort of, McCain was almost harking back to Eisenhower's famous farewell address. Wasn't he talking about the Iron Triangle, the kind of what Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address, the military-industrial complex? I distinctly recall that.
It was not a central part of his campaign message.
Right.
No question that even for someone who is a very ardent supporter of a strong U.S. military, and most, including himself, would call him a very strong hawk, he was wary about the very interwoven relationship between the military and the Defense Department and the private sector, the military-industrial complex. I admire your memory because, like I said, it wasn't a central part of his campaign message. If you remember that year, he really focused his campaign, not only his message but agenda, on the topic of campaign finance reform, which is really the animating issue that drove him into the race
right.
in 1999 and 2000. But no question, over the years, he has frequently cited President Eisenhower's warning on that front, that even for someone who supported a strong military, being careful about the influences on it from outside the government.
So, Dan, you became an independent, right, after being a lifelong Republican, but I think you did so before the more prominent ex-McCain people, Steve Schmidt and Nicole Wallace, who are now regulars on MSNBC.
I did become a no-party preference voter in California several years ago, yes.
Right. So what are we to make then of what's happening on Saturday, the conspicuous absence of the president and the fact that two former presidents, George W. Bush, who I'm sure you remember how bitter the campaign was in South Carolina, but they seem to have healed that rift, and of course Barack Obama, who he also ran against.
Well, I don't know, and I wouldn't presume to know, that he ever became close friends with either George Bush or Barack Obama. But I think there's a few things that were going on with his decision before his death to make it clear that he wanted both of those former presidents to speak at his service, but not the current president. One, of course, I think was a very typical instinct toward bipartisanship. And if that's a message that he articulated throughout his career, it only makes sense to have the most recent Democratic president and the most recent Republican president speaking at that service. Number two, of course, is his very ill-disguised feelings toward the president. And I think any man or woman is entitled to let it be known that they don't want someone who they don't care for to attend their funeral and memorial service. And John McCain made it very clear that he thought so little of President Trump that he didn't want him there. But then third, I think there's another point that's gotten overlooked in a lot of the media coverage, the bipartisanship and the Trump animus. It's worth remembering that both, aside from being elected president, both George Bush and Barack Obama defeated John McCain in his quest toward a goal that he very strongly aspired to. And while I certainly would not for a moment suggest that John McCain was flawless. By his own admission, he's a very, very flawed man. But I think it is a mark of character that he invited the two men who defeated him in his quest for the presidency to speak at his service. It's not a bipartisan
decision.
Decision in its entirety, but it's a different kind of rapprochement, and
right.
It's a nice way of saying I might not have achieved all my goals, but I do admire these two men. And if you look back at the speech that Senator McCain gave on election night 2008, when he talked about the historical import of then Senator Obama's election, I think it reflects the same sentiment.
Well, Dan Schneur, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dan Schneur, who's a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications and the University of California Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies. For years, Dan was one of California's leading political and media strategists, whose record includes work on four presidential and three gubernatorial campaigns, and he served as the national director of communications for the 2000 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.